This episode is brought to you by 6 Feet Up, the Python, Django, and AI experts who solve hard software problems. Whether it's scaling an application, deriving insights from data, or getting results from AI, 6 Feet Up helps you move forward faster. See what's possible at 6feetup.com. Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat. I'm Will Vincent with Carlton Gibson. Hey, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very, very pleased to have Samuel Pacu from La Suite Numérique join us today. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Happy to be here.
Yes. So even in America, the work that you're doing has raised quite a stir of having open source software to replace Microsoft and Zoom and other things. Perhaps you could tell us just broadly what you do day to day, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, so I work for DINIMS. It's the French Interministerial Directorate for Digital Affairs. We are attached to the French Prime Minister, and my day-to-day work is to build a set of applications, which we call La Suite, for daily work. So they are this instant messaging, emailing, video conferencing, organizing, sharing files and drives, collaborative editing, spreadsheets. We even added an AI chatbot recently. So everything for the daily work. And we do it for state agents, for public agents, but we do it in open source. So there's also a community growing around what we do.
Yeah. And then I think before that, you were working in education. Is that right? Also for the government?
Yeah, so I've been working for DINIM for 2 years, 2 years and a half. And before that, I was working in the higher education sector, also doing Django with a lot of OpenEdX, if you know OpenEdX.
Yeah,
it's one of the, that's one of the big Django projects. I worked for 6 or 7 years in France Université Numérique. So that's the equivalent of DINIM before universities. We provide digital services for universities, cloud services.
And then I think the history is that during COVID, is that when there was efforts started to make these services available across government? Was that kind of when things started around 2022 or so, I think?
Definitely it accelerated things, but I was working in universities. I was working before COVID. When the COVID started, we were the first team to spin up a Jitsi instance, and we had also collaborative editing. We tried to give tools to our agents, which were suddenly at home and had nothing to work. So because we were able to very quickly put up services online, people started to notice us and send us more money and say, okay, we need more of this because people are remote and they need to work. So I think that's when people realized that open source was where people had a very fast response to these issues, and they started giving more money to open source projects. While I was in France Université Numérique, in DINIM, they were also able to propose tools and with open source, but these were standalone tools. We didn't have a full digital workspace interoperable applications. And so that was the next step, was to say, okay, now people are, after COVID, people started to say, okay, we need to switch to Office 365. And public agents, they didn't have these online tools. They were just working on their laptops. And after the COVID, people started to want to move to Office 365. That was raising a lot of questions in the French public sector to say, okay, are we really sovereign if everybody moves online? We started to realize that these daily tools, they are not just, they are very important because all your data and all the work you do is done in these tools. So they are really, in fact, they are not just a detail. They are really core to your sovereignty, your data and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that the digital sovereignty aspect is sort of the driving force?
Yeah, I think there's also cost. There's cost and the digital sovereignty there, because in the public sector, we wouldn't have enough money to pay all the licenses for all our public agents. So they were starting to say, okay, let's give Office 365 to only the top level,
the executive
managers, or they were starting to have this kind of decisions. And no, that's not what we want. And because there was also a big problem with digital sovereignty, then they started to see a solution with open source. But really, frankly, when I arrived in Dinam, nobody thought that we can do it. And I myself didn't know what I was going to be able to do. And that's when we started to have top one in Hacker News with Docs, and then Visio later. And then we start to believe in ourselves, saying like, okay, we are able to do it, and we can, maybe it's easier than we thought. No.
Okay.
Maybe it can be done.
Can I ask about a couple of things there then, about the team size and then the funding behind that? What sort of backing do you have? Because
the backing is growing. Like, you know, when in the public service, when you come, they give you just a little bit, they see what you can do, and then they can give you more. So when I took the team, the budget was about like between 5-6 million maybe. Okay. Everything was used to pay licenses. So I had to work nights, weekends to start Docs and Visio. We started it as a student project. We did it on our spare time. And then slowly, when we did top one in Hacker News, people say, okay, maybe we should give them more money. And then, so today, that suite is roughly around 10 million budget, maybe.
Okay.
It's about 80 people, 35 developers, mostly freelancers. That's the figures.
But that's super. No? That's to have, you know, be able to put a team of that size together. That's not a small team. That's a big group.
Yeah, it's the potential is huge. Like when you know, the state alone in France is 2.9 million agents.
Yeah.
And if you consider the whole public service in France, it's 6 million agents. So the potential for these open source tools is huge, only in the public sector. And that's why it's strategic to. It can be done in the public sector. It can't be done in the private sector by just a company starting and say, I'm going to make a suite with open source and spread it. This wouldn't work. So we thought that, okay, the public sector can make this happen.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And then just the cost savings has to be very high, right? Because team licenses, especially for enterprises, be millions of dollars that's saved separate from the cost invested in your team.
Yeah, I think I can say today that we saved more money, we saved more public money than we invested. So yes, but it's not so easy to say, okay, I mean, you save 10 million, so give me 10 more millions. That's what we're doing. So yes, we can make savings, and I think if people make the correct calculations, we would have to go faster, but it's more complex.
Can I just swing back momentarily? Because did we introduce the suite? Because I know what it is. That's why we've invited you on. But did we really introduce for the listeners what the La Suite Numérique is doing now?
Okay, so what? It's a suite of application. I don't know if you want to go into each application.
Well,
there's also a core of La Suite, which is growing, which is based on Django and other applications which are not. So we can maybe focus on the Django applications.
Yeah.
But there were some existing tools when I joined. The first one is a tool called CHAP, which is basically a government instance of metrics. So that's 400,000 active users, monthly active users as we speak on the metrics federation for the French states.
Is that, is metrics, that's the same as messaging, like instant messaging?
Yeah, that's instant messaging. And it's a decentralized and end-to-end encrypted protocol for instant messaging.
Okay.
It's quite successful. There are more than 100,000 nodes in the world. in the open community, in the Open Federation of Metrics. We have a private federation. It's quite successful also in Regalian environments and governments.
Because regulated, of this
This encrypted and distributed nature of metrics.
Okay.
Can I ask about on that and then the other projects, the hosting? I assume it also has to be like servers based in France. You're not using AWS in, Washington, D.C.
Yeah, we have a certification in France called Secnum Cloud, which includes protection against extraterritorial access. So it excludes American-led clouds. So yes, but we have several instances. We use public cloud with this certification of Secnum Cloud. So it could be the French hyperscalers are like OVH or Scaleway. If they have this certification, we can use them. But we also have internal clouds, internal to the states, where we can have specific instances with more security. And that's the interesting thing with open source is that once we have the product, we can deploy it tens of times in air gap, in classified environments, in open environments, and it also spreads outside of the state. So that's interesting. It compounds.
that's one thing that I'm interested to follow up on is like, because I think once you've built the foundation, there is a real chance to, if it makes it easy enough to install and people can run it themselves, there's a real growth opportunity there. The market, the cathedral and the bazaar type, approach could really apply here.
And it does. It's really starting to pick up. The especially on docs and Visio. Visio was used by gamers. Because in Visio, you can share several screens at the same time, and you can stream it to RTMP. So you can stream it to YouTube and this kind of. Yeah. So gamers started using Visio. It was packaged for NixOS as well. So very easy to deploy. And it's funny because the people who packaged it for NixOS, they made a fork activating all some features for gamers. Mm-hmm. That was the first community that started using Visio. And then, as we speak, there are, I don't know how many instances there are, but it's growing. And we have people who developed a full mobile application last month, and it's coming. Like contributions are starting to come. Yeah.
Okay, but so you've got messaging, you've got meetings, you've got files, you've got email, you've got
spreadsheets.
That's the difficulty. When you want to build a digital workspace, you have to build a lot of applications and need to be big. And we are not that big either. So we hope we need the community to take on this and to help. I've been working on Django for 10 years and we have about 10 developers who are really experienced on Django. And so we reuse what we do a lot. There's a joke in LastSuite saying that everything is a fork of docs. And if in the case of Drive is literally a fork of docs with just a small change in the front end. We replace the editor by a file browser, and that's it. That's a tree, documents, and with access rights. It's really, really close. So we managed to, because Django and React, we master our frameworks, we're able to reuse a lot of what we do. And we try to cover the whole digital workspace with the resources we have, which are growing, but slowly, and trying to embark the community and be smart. Okay.
And then I think Django REST framework is the, what you're using, right? Like you must have been tempted by Django Ninja and maybe some other tools. Like how is Django REST framework holding up for you, I guess is the question.
I think our approach is we've been working together for 10 years, like this team, and we had our habits and the way we do things. And we focused on what we can build as fast as possible.
Yeah.
And we didn't take the time to, like Django Ninja, when we started, I was looking at it and I hesitated, but it was really the beginning of big, I couldn't find like a big project in production that would make me feel really safe to use it. So I just went on with REST frameworks, which we were using for several years. Then lately, I saw Django Bolt, and I'm really, really excited with Django Bolt. But you know, there would be a lot of rewrites.
Yeah.
I think we would love to stop and make this move, but it's also not like you don't need to. So if you just focus on what you ship and what your impact, the tools and your users, tools it's good enough. We master it. We know we can do whatever we want, and it's not rocket science. What we do is really, it serializes use and models. We've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
Know how to optimize it. We don't even have cache yet on docs or drive. And yeah, we know we have really room for optimizations before we need to go to Django Bolt, for example. So
Django Bolt's super exciting that you can get an awful lot of requests per second, but if your application isn't anywhere hitting the limits of what you can already do, that's it's a big rewrite just for fun.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people on the forums, and they very often you see haters like saying, "Oh, everything is good about this project except the choice of Django." But the truth is, then they say, "Oh, Python is so slow when you choose Django." But I mean, when you build these applications, you know that the speed of your application is really, most of the time it's just in the database or the way you make your queries.
Exactly, 1,000%. 1,000%. Yeah. It's just like people don't know what they're talking about. Oh my God.
And if we can, you know, we are doing API, so if you can cache something at the serializer level, and you know, maybe we're already super fast, more than what we can do. In France University Numérique, we had a video, like a YouTube platform equivalence, and we had 3 million users on it, and we had only one pod because like it's just serving video tokens, and so everything was in cache, and so we could serve like so many requests with just a pod. So yeah, sometimes it's just not where the pain is.
Yeah, no. Yeah, okay. Perfect.
I wanted to ask.
We love the URM. We love the URM in Django, so.
Okay.
I wanted to ask about ProConnect, which I think is SSO across government, because I think one of the, is it correct? One of the challenges before was getting adoption was login, and maybe you could speak to introducing that and why that, I think, led to a lot more users for you.
Yeah, because basically, like I was saying, you have 2.9 million users in the States, agents in the States, but they are everywhere. They are in each ministry. They are in small entities. Organizations are everywhere. And it's nothing like hierarchical. There's no one who can say, let's do that, and everybody follows. It's a state. So it's designed to be complex and have independence between teams so that not one person can decide for everybody. You know, that could be creepy. So that's also, you need to convince people that your tools are good, and to convince them they need to have access to your tools.
Yeah, right.
And that could be really, really a headache. So we were able to put up a SSO which has everybody behind one button, and they could log in one click. So that was really, really important in our distribution strategy for our tools.
To make it easy for people to onboard, right? So to give it a try, kick the wheels.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And I think we get a lot of inspiration from UK, which are really were ahead of us on all this government IT. We get inspiration. In France, we have France Connect. We had France Connect for end users. With like 100 million connections per month, and it was working really well. But so we forked it and used it for agents.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned, you know, it's obviously a French-based project. I'm wondering whether other governments in the EU are picking it up and joining in. And
yeah, it's, I would say across the EU, there is the subject of sovereignty, which is growing, and we talk to a lot of governments. But what we don't have is like, we don't have a common response. Like everybody say, okay, let's do this, and everybody, you do this, I do that, and that's it. We're not able to do this. So I would say it's important that everybody, that the concern is raising, and open source is quite, it's seen as a solution in several countries, especially Germany, France, the Netherlands also is joining us on this. So yes, it's there's a concern, but I would say we are not there where our efforts compound, not yet.
Okay.
Try to work together. But for example, with Germany and Holland, we, and the Netherlands, we try to work together, but the approaches are quite different. So I wouldn't say that we're very, very successful to add our efforts to compound. Yeah.
But that might come over time, right? I mean, the European project is still quite nascent.
Yeah, I think whatever steps we take, eventually we align. Like if one country pushes something forward, another country pushes something else forward, eventually everybody gets aligned behind what works. So yeah. It's also good that everybody is trying a different approach, and if you hope that what works gets spread
as well, one would think that a diversity of approaches will lead to a richer solution in the end. Is that it might take slightly longer to get off the ground, but hang on, the Dutch perspective there brings something that we hadn't considered to the table.
So. Yes. Yes, but there are also some ways to go backward sometimes. Like, you know, like you're in the public sector, so you have a lot of pressure, a lot of lobbies.
Yeah.
When you succeed in something, the people come for you. They can, you know, you can lose some battles. You have to continue fighting. Okay, so you have to hope that you have a positive impact on these things, but it's never ending.
Okay. The other question, sort of just at the top of my sort of tongue, is like how to get involved. From the listeners have, you know, seen last week Numerique, and you know, if they want to download it, install it themselves, is it easy to get going? Or
we're trying to make it easy. It's gotten quite easy on docs, on the projects that have the most the biggest community.
Yeah.
So we make it containerized. We have Docker Compose. If you go to docs, you pull the repository, you make Bootstrap. Nobody works on your laptop. If you're a developer and you have Docker on your computer, it should be working within minutes.
Okay.
On going to production, we focus on Kubernetes. Like we provide everything for Kubernetes deployment to production in minutes, like Helm charts. We have official images and everything. So, and documentation. So if you run Kubernetes, it's easy. If you don't, okay, you're more on your own. Yeah, more on your own. But if you master Django, it should be too hard. Like it's, yeah.
Okay, so you have.
If you use Docker Compose in production, if you want to build a VM from scratch with the old way, then okay, you're on your own.
Okay, good.
But we hope the community comes also to contribute all this. And other projects, on other projects who are more recent or on which we did less community work, maybe there's less documentation, could be a bit harder. So still work in progress to really make it easy to deploy.
Right. Okay. I mean, presumably I could reach out, open an issue. I'm trying to deploy this. I'm trying to do that. And
yeah, of course we have metrics channels, which are mentioned in our readmes.
Okay.
You can open issues. We're quite active. We're quite responsive on all this. One thing maybe is that obviously we build applications for scale, like we're talking million users.
Yes.
So we make some choices, which are like we make object storage first. We make choices for scale, OIDC first, everything. So if you're a very small company and you just want to have a VM,
yeah.
And pay the VM €1 per month, and you want to install everything on it, you need to be scaled because you will need to have a OIDC provider. You will need to have a object storage. A lot of people, they will, if you want a very small instance, they will realize that it's not what we focus on. So if you don't have S3, then...
This portion of Django Chat is brought to you by 6FeetUp. What's stopping you? Maybe it's an application that won't scale or an AI initiative that just isn't delivering. That's where 6FeetUp comes in. With deep expertise in Python, Django, and AI, they solve hard software problems, modernize platforms, and get teams to market faster. Their impact speaks for itself. Automating healthcare pipelines for hospitals, helping NASA explore Pluto, building severe weather prediction tools, and applying AI to connect farmers with vital crop data. When the stakes are high and the problems are hard, 6FeetUp is the partner that delivers. See what's possible at 6FeetUp is the partner that
difficult for you. Yeah.
But there's an interesting contribution opportunity for people, like the people who want to scale it down to come along and, you know.
So some people have installed it on the YouKnowHost. I don't know if you know this project, YouKnowHost.
No.
No.
That's like,
no,
yeah, maybe it's French. It's quite used in free software communities. It's like a box on which you can self-host a lot of applications without doing like heavy sysadmin. You can click and install your... So they have put Visio, they've put Grist, Docs. You can install it with a click. I'm not in favor of these approaches so much because sometimes you make it look like it's easy, but when you run an object storage cluster, and it's not so easy. You know, you still need skills in case something goes wrong. So yeah, if you hide too much complexity, if you hide the complexity too much, sometimes people can have problems.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I always think about is it's okay when the complex system is running nicely, but what happens when it breaks? Can you dig down and work out what the separate parts were?
Yeah, so I advise people that maybe if you want to host it, you can... We have a proxy that encrypts your data for your S3, for your object storage. So I would advise that you open a bucket on a provider, and if you want sovereignty of your data, you can encrypt. Although you put it on a bucket on the cloud, you can encrypt your data on this S3. But at least you don't have to operate it. You're not scared to lose your data. So that's what I advise. It's cheap to have a bucket. So.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Well, there's also for French hosting providers, there's Scalingo, which is similar to Heroku. Yeah. I actually had a conversation with the developer advocate there, because I was surprised. I hadn't heard about it until Heroku shut down again. But they have proc files. They've been going 10 years. I believe they work with the government a little bit, but it's a very, very easy to use option.
Yeah, we work with them, so you can deploy to Scalingo. We have some instances on Scalingo. There's also Clever Cloud in France, which does the same thing. It's a PaaS as well, and they have detailed how-tos of how to deploy docs. And yeah, that's a good option as well, but maybe more expensive if you're really looking for cheap hosting. So. Yeah, you basically need solutions for all the profiles.
Yeah, yeah. Machine, five machines, manage for me. You need all of those eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
But the project is very open to contributions, right? If people want to come in, add to the docs on a deployment story or something like that, they could do that.
Okay, so the project is started by us. So that's public agents. The repositories, there's no open governance at the moment. But that's one of our main objectives. When we say we want to do digital commons, we mean that we want the governance to be shared. We want to just be one of the contributors. We are still hoping to bring other countries, companies, integrators, hosters, to contribute and slowly take over governance with the community. We are not there yet. And we frankly don't know exactly how it will be done, but that's where we want to go. I think Docs is a bit ahead and will be the first repository that we will really open. Most probably send it to a foundation and really look for an open governance. There are some communities, I don't know how much I can say, but there are some communities in the open source, in the free software, communities that are putting offers to Denim to take the code and start to organize this for us. I don't know what will happen. I frankly don't know, but I really, really hope that this goes through.
That'd be really cool, though. You know, it's a cool thing you've built, and it's, you know, open source, but then to give it an open governance model gives it sustainability into the, you know, medium and long term, hopefully.
And maybe we can discuss. I'd be interested to discuss with like Django people, Django foundations, and see, because these are the people who would be interested to be active in this community. So, what are the best practices? What are examples? What has been done? And yeah, we are, at the moment we are looking what's possible. And yeah,
but that's a cool goal. So how did you end up in this, you know, great situation? You're working on what's a really cool project in a kind of socially worthy thing at the cutting edge of technology, doing some really good stuff. And how did you? This is a kind of dream job, no? To roll into?
No. No, I wouldn't say it's a dream job. I don't know if you're on LinkedIn, but it's quite, I don't know how long you can hold on this kind of job. You know, it's quite active and quite exposed. So, but when you succeed, it's good, but not a dream job. It's what I was looking for. So, but it's not easy. So, maybe if it was a bit easier, it would be the dream job. How did that
end up here? Golf on a Friday, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I ended up here, but because I was Django developer, and the first I became a developer to grow a family. Like, I was looking for a job that would really accommodate taking care of a family, during the day. And when my kids were small, I was coding at night. I wanted something really flexible. So I came to coding quite late. I was past 30 years old. And before that, I was working in international commerce. So it gives me a profile, a bit double profile of learning coding late and having a international business experience before. And so that's a strength that really allows me to navigate in the complexity of public sector open source stuff.
I can imagine in public sector there's an amount of politics, there's an amount of people management.
Yeah, and the interesting thing when you're an open you're a developer, and I had also a strong free software, I would say background or color, and so you come with a mission, you see something that goes wrong in your country, or something like digital sovereignty was really an issue. I've always been sensitive to this, predatory software. But that was always a big issue for me, really from young. And I think I came back to this with the excuse of building a family and having a more flexible job, but it was in my head that, okay, that's one thing that's important for me. So yeah. And when coming to it, I started to learn coding for 10 years as a freelance and slowly moved to really to open source. And it was progressive. When I arrived in France University Numérique, I was coming for open education more than for open source. I was not really in the open source communities. I was using Django, but not really. I was not really a free software advocate in France or known for this. And then from working in the open education, and slowly I started to really know where to start having strategy of how to do it, how can we make it happen. And the strategy I'm applying at DNIM is quite controversial. It's still quite controversial, even in the free software communities, in the private software. So because we succeed, people start to see, oh, maybe that's something interesting the way they do it. But it's controversial. Like, we are in the middle of the open source movement, the free software movement, and the political things. And yes. We need to convince everybody that this is how you get impact. This is how you keep control of your software, of your data. So our success gives us gives this strategy a voice.
Yes.
But I wasn't sure when I applied it that it was going to work. Ooh. I can elaborate a bit more if you want on this.
No, but it seems you have to build on the successes one at a time, right? You have to, get documents out the door. And look, it's working and people are using it and it's, within our own control.
Yes. Well, when you succeed something, then people start to think that, okay, they misunderstood something. If not, they will think they are right and you must be wrong. So when you succeed something, then we can talk again that, okay, see, this thing you said that I was going to fail, but in fact, I succeeded. So that's why I succeeded. Do you agree with this? Okay, yes, you agree with this. So now I propose that we go this way.
Yeah, okay.
So that gives us opportunity to maybe build it's very interesting that some people come see me and say, okay, we were trying to do this for 20 years in France. We didn't know how to do it. Please explain how you did it because we want to apply it in other sectors. What's the recipe for this?
Yeah.
And the recipe is, there's a big debate here on the make or buy. Should you, when your government should be coding, like people will say, no, as government, you shouldn't be coding. You should just be defining the specifications, the interfaces, the standards, and that's it. Your job is done. So maybe in some countries that's what the role of the state is. But in France, the state sector is much, much bigger. We were saying like 6 million agents. And I don't think the history proves that when you're not coding and you're trying to regulate stuff and declare standards and specifications. If you're not coding, you have no idea what you're talking about. AI is coming, and I also have no idea before I start coding what it should be. Now we are working on interfaces. I was mentioning that now that we succeeded some applications, we want to make them interchangeable so that when people sell digital workplaces, We have a standard that we want to call Open Bureau. And if you comply to these standards, you can change a drive for another drive, a video conferencing for another video conferencing, and it will work in your digital workspace. And when we started building this, we realized how difficult it is. Because it's not just saying that's web dev or that's FTP or whatever. You can't just say that. If you don't trust the drive, doesn't trust the video conferencing application, need to go down to the scenario. You need a token and you need to know what you will allow one application to do in the other application on behalf of the user or how long. A little bit like the S3 policy, S3 policy, you can craft a S3 policy, but you will say you're allowed to push a file at this place, at this path, this maximum size, this type of file, for you have 30 minutes to do it, and then that's it.
Yeah.
And so you go down to the scenario and you say, okay, this is how it should work. But if you're not the developer doing it, how can you specify it? So I'm trying to tell people I can't, if I don't make, I can't buy. If I don't make, I can't specify.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. I'm obviously from Britain originally, and the opposite approach was always taken. Let's just outsource everything. Let's do it all in the private sector for efficient. And that, like all things, you can swing the pendulum one way or the other and it can go too far. But the reality is you can't specify software with sufficient clarity to be able to outsource it totally. And so you end up with, you know, the history of British IT projects over the last 30 years has been one of overspends and, misspecifications and then, you know, budget doubling and all the rest.
Yeah, but I think what's missed in that is, like, it's not just incompetence, like the corruption is the point.
There's also corruption, but there's also, there's both. There's everything.
Yeah, to the barricades, Will. Yes, absolutely. But it's a kind of logical impossibility to specify the software up front until you're in the weeds writing it, right? It's something that we have at the smallest scale. We're writing our own applications, but it must apply 100-fold at government scale.
Yeah. So, and another thing is, when we started coding, some people said you need to give us orders. And so maybe they're right that it's important to that the public sector is not going to do everything on its own. Yeah, and I always thought of, like, if I want to succeed last week, I cannot just succeed in the French state. If I do this, in 5 years, someone will come and say, how come French state has its own digital workspace where everybody's doing something else? So the project can only be, we are building tools for our agents, but building it with open source. I mean, public money should go to public code, and our ambition should be to make an alternative to what the hegemons we have today that pose a sovereignty issue. And so we want an open software. We want open software in Europe. We want diversity, and this is the only success. We can't have success if we don't manage this. And so that when you say that, then your project has become 10 times harder. So, that's why I'm doing a lot of politics, because I can't just succeed by coding stuff that my users use. I need to code stuff that the community takes, that other government takes, that private sector takes, that, everybody should be able to get value from it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is the problem of success. You're asked to boil the ocean. You succeeded in one thing and then nine more problems and it's a success problem, but still a problem.
Yeah, but we had a bigger problem. So we are in a better place now than 2 years ago. We still have a lot of work. But where would we be if we hadn't started it 2 years ago?
Yeah, okay.
Like when I joined, there were already two ministers in France who had asked for a derogation to use Office 365, and all the other ministries were asking derogations as well. And now no one is asking derogations, and they give us part of the money to build a suite. So we are in a better place, and we think if we continue, we are allowed to continue and grow out of the state. It's always something that will be good.
That's really building a common. That's really building a digital commons at that point. Like, you know, something of value, not just for the citizens of Europe, but for anywhere. So that's fantastic. Can I ask you? Was it just your historical background that led to Django, or why Django?
Okay, in my case, why Django? It's my brother, so I would need to ask my brother why Django.
Yeah,
I think he was doing Python, and I think why I stick to Django is maybe, like I was saying, my background was I had an engineering background, but not a developer, and so I wanted to make things done. Like, I wanted to make things, and I was less attached to the tech than to what I could do with it. And then that's what I like in Django, right? You know, the efficiency, batteries included, you can ship something. I really love the, also I always liked the Zen of Python, clean code. Yeah. I feel that's, it's more than the product, like it's more than the code, is the community.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think in, elsewhere in the world, there are bigger Django communities, but in France, it's really small. Like in France, PHP has remained bigger than elsewhere for many reasons. So Python and Django community is a very small world where everybody knows each other. It's like really a family spirit. And so I was attached to it. Like very fast, you know, more or less. I was a freelancer, so more or less, you know, everybody. And there was really like a quality approach to code. And that's how we existed. Like the Django community 10 years ago existed by the being making things differently than the rest of the world.
Okay.
That's what I liked. And now it's the boring tech. It's really, it works. It will work in 20 years.
Yeah.
The solution for you, every problem is already solved in a elegant way. I mean, that's the second best tool for anything.
And AI,
AI for me is making the choice of Django even more obvious, because it's the same engineers, and you see a lot of people from the Django community who have now moved to the AI community. When you go to Python, I went to EuroPython in 2021 and before ChatGPT, and yeah, it was already, everybody was talking AI. You have huge community around AI in Python, so makes a lot of sense to do Python today, and together with Rust, I think it's really also, it makes it maybe future-proof. It could be discussed, but I still feel very comfortable with this framework.
Okay,
I think that outside of the U.S. and China, I mean, France in AI has Mistral, has Hugging Face. It's very strong. I would say it's number three, at just in my head, in terms of public-facing companies that are doing cutting-edge AI stuff.
That's more on the mathematical, I would say. It's more the mathematical education than the Python, than the coding. I think so, because all the people you mentioned, they are from the same school in France.
Yeah.
So there's a very,
Well, let me make a specific question. You had mentioned at the beginning adding AI-enabled features to La Suite. How are you doing that? Is that local models? Is that, like, what models are you allowed to use? I assume maybe not, you know, Anthropic? That's a sovereignty question.
No, we don't use SAS. We run models locally on our infrastructures. So we run them on Kubernetes. It's become quite easy. Now there are a lot of tools in Kubernetes to do that. So we run models, and we run all types of models. Like we can run a Whisper. We have also live transcoding, LLM, LVM, any type of model we could run. But our approach to AI is, we know our limits. We're not AI engineers, and we try to use AI for use case. We try to not invent a use case, and we take an existing use case, something that really works or already works obviously, and we try to bring it to our tools. So for example, in Visio we will bring transcription, live transcription, asynchronous transcription and live transcription, summary of the transcription. In Docs we have basic editing features, like text generation features. And in files, in the drive, we do a RAG. We try to index to make semantic search. We try to work on OCR, on indexing any type of document efficiently. So these are all use cases that are mastered, and that really you just need to run a model and make a little bit of identic or a little bit of front end and make it work. That's the approach we have now. Okay. It works, but we could be better. Yeah, we would need some help. We could take some help on this part of our products.
But you know, I look at the products coming out of say the glossy device company from California, and their AI doesn't seem any better. So.
Yes, some people come and say, "Hey, we come from this tool, and we went to Docs, and wow, your AI works better." Okay, but we only use open source models.
Okay,
I think that's the future. We could talk longer about that. I work at JetBrains, which makes IDEs, PyCharm, and you can bring whatever model you want. So you can bring private models, you can bring open source models, and the inference costs alone every 3 months, I think, are dropping dramatically. So I suspect that will be more and more important for cost, for security. And they're good enough a lot of the time.
Yeah,
I think it's getting better.
There's one thing in which I believe in AI is you see a lot of experiments and a lot of people will show you cool things with AI. But do they control the code? Do they control the data and the people's access to bring AI on people's documents and on people's workflows, everyday use of the tools? So if your people if everybody is in Office 365, then you don't choose the model that they'd be using. So why do you do all these AI projects? Because your people are every day in the tool, which you don't control. You can either pay the AI feature or don't pay it and you don't get it. So we believe also that because we do the infrastructure stuff, because we do the structural stuff and control our data and our users, we'll be able to bring the use case and to bring usage to the models that we run.
Yeah.
And something that we see very few people manage doing and that we are able to do is that our applications, we have OIDC to authenticate our users in each of our application. And not only our application, any application in the French state which decides to connect to our SSO is in this federation, in this OIDC federation. And we use one spec of the OIDC, one part of the OIDC spec, which talks about server-to-server authentication. And so when someone is logged in on one app, the server of this app can make a call to another app on behalf of the person who is logged in with the special access rights, which I was mentioning, to secure with we can get a token for a special use case. And so we are able to tell any application in the French state would get the right to push a file to our drive on behalf of the users that is logged in. And so this also applies to our chatbots and to our global search index. I know Google did it 20 years ago, but with French agents still didn't have it. So now we have a global search with semantic search, with AI indexation. And whichever application which is on our SSO can push data to this global search. And then users can query this global search from another application on behalf of the user. Our chatbot has tools that can interrogate this search with the access right of the user. And these very people know how to do that. Safely with keeping control of your data and allowing your users to query data live and do. I don't know if I explained it well, but
no, you did. That's amazing. I worked at a startup 10 years ago that was trying to do that for bring your Google in, bring your Dropbox in, bring all your things in, and have one search box for everything. And the permissions were difficult. They used Algolia, which is that French as well, I think, originally?
Yes, French. Yeah, that's our inspiration for Global Find.
Yeah, so it would. It's a really good idea. And it's very, very difficult to do, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, because I worked on it a little bit.
Actually, it's not that hard when you control. If you control.
Yeah, when you control, maybe it's easier.
Yeah, we use Open Search. I did this project. I started this project in just 2 weeks. It's very, very basic projects. It's in the 100 lines of code. It's called Find. You can find it in our GitHub. It's called Find. It's basically an open search with two views. One, mm-hmm. to push data. To push data, you need to have a token, a service account, and any app that gets a service account can have its own index and push data. So that's very basic. And on the front-end side for queries, we use this resource server, this OIDC resource server specification. And then it's really easy because you just need a field for each document that's being pushed. We have one field with the users, with the list of users who have direct access, specific access to this document. We have another field for any group that have access to this document. And we have a few flags to say if it's public reach or it's not, it could be not restricted to these people or to these users or groups, but it could be public. And with just this, we're able to secure access and make a search that is restricted to what you can access. So it's really, actually, really basic. And the resource server part is a specification. We have a few classes, a few hundred lines of Python to check those tokens with the OIDC provider. But it's really not rocket science. And that's really...
It's very, very cool, though. Right, it's very cool. Yeah. Even someone who doesn't know how to code that solves a big problem for them, right?
Yes, that's a big problem. And if you don't know how to do this, you know, I see some colleagues who come up with, oh, we have this AI demo, it's really cool. And then tell them, okay, how are you going to plug it? How are you going to give it to people and plug it to their tools? And then that becomes it becomes much harder.
Okay. So can I ask, what's on the roadmap for La Suite Numérique? Because you seem to have gone from strength to strength. And what's next?
Yeah, one thing that we miss and that people are asking us a lot is we have the chat bot. We have the chat, the instant messaging, and we have Visio. People are asking for Teams, basically for chat, for Slack. The Slack experience.
Slack, Slack. Teams, though. Yeah.
So that's something people ask. And that's something we don't want to leave unanswered. So yeah, that's something that's next for La Suite. We don't know yet what technology, and maybe that's one of the weakness in Django to everything WebSockets, you know, at scale. So we don't know yet whether we use Matrix, whether we'll use something like a pub sub in another language. We're not sure yet. We know Django is not the best tool for that at the moment with channels. And maybe I missed something, and I'd be interested if someone thinks that there's a way to do it.
Yeah, it's the ease of scaling that, the tool I'm looking at the moment actually is called Hornbeam, which is written by Benoit, whose surname escapes me this moment, but he's been the maintainer of Gunicorn to Unicorn for a long time. He's put out an Erlang server with Python integration. As well.
I saw him in Fosdem. I met him in Fosdem.
But that's a lovely looking project in terms of if you want the kind of low latency, high concurrency environment of Erlang, and then you can have your application logic in Python doing your normal thing. So it's a server called Hornbeam that I've been eyeing up very, very much.
So another thing that we're working on now, but it's quite advanced, we are finalizing the first box proof of concept, is end-to-end encryption on all our tools.
Okay.
So, yeah. So we'll have a global enrollment to get your private key, and we have a multi-device enrollment to get a key. And once you have a key globally for the suite, any application can ask to encode something in the browser, and then when we did our application, we knew that we wanted to go this way. So docs, fichier, drive, everything is already planned to be end-to-end encrypted. Like the server is dumped. So that's one thing. We also have a big challenge to, of course, continue growing the community, continue getting more active users in the French state, because that's how people evaluate our work.
Okay, so there's the entry point for a question. Then is okay. Django users listening to the show think, hang on, I want to check this out. What's the entryway to NetSuite's community and to get involved? And
probably our GitHub, github.com/suite-numerique. Maybe you can give the link. From our GitHub, you can see the different projects, and on the readmes, you find the metrics channel. You can open issues. You can talk to us like this. You can find us on maybe on social networks, Mastodon, Twitter, or LinkedIn.
That's what you need. You need to make a social network for the French state. Something that's some of those.
Okay, one thing that's happening that we didn't talk about is that one thing that we succeeded doing with other European countries is we did an EDIC. It's a European infrastructure.
Oh, I saw this.
Consortium.
You gave a presentation. I'll put a link with a Leia, German colleague, I think.
But that just started. The EDIC was created end of December 2025. The new director has just been appointed and will start working. And so the EDIC is here to organize investment in commons at the European level. And there should be big project, big financing coming, and that could be piped to this consortium. So we hope, cross fingers, that but the European Commission has announced that they want to push open source at the European level. So the EDIC is a good vehicle for this, and there is a strong will to push social network, open source, and more. Yeah, there is this will. I'm not sure it will be our team. I don't think it will be done at the French state level.
Right.
Once you have this edict with financing inside, I think it goes much beyond what we can do inside the French government. Yeah.
I mean, there's been a lot of good stuff come out of, I think it's the German Sovereign Tech Fund, which is in a similar space.
I love, and also NGI. Do you know NGI?
No, I haven't heard of NGI. What's that one?
It's NLNet. Okay, I'm not sure. Sovereign Tech Fund is to finance the maintenance of core open source libraries like FFmpeg or SSH, these kind of core projects. And they just give them money, and they evaluate their success by the impact on everybody in the companies who have dependencies on these libraries. So the project is really to make it more stable. NLNet is financing very small projects that most of the time is like a group of two, three developers who say, hey, I'm going to code a new object storage, decentralized object storage with Rust. And they say, oh, okay, we give you $50K for that. And they literally take 2 days to decide to give you $50K. And then they are really, it's done by developers. It's done by really technical people. So they really look at your code, they look at your pull request. They're going to really a technical evaluation of what you did. And so it's a really efficient way to finance innovation, open source innovation. And a lot of projects that we use in NetSuite come from NLNet.
Okay.
So for example, in Docs, the editor, the BlockNote editor, financed by NLNet. It's a Dutch guy who was financed by NLNet. There are many small projects that come from this financing.
Yeah, so we'll put a link to it. I see that. I think their budget is a lot bigger than the Sovereign Tech Fund. It's maybe 10 times bigger. So, Carlton, you should apply.
Definitely.
maybe. I think that's for young people.
And then EDIC could be like what we think, like there's one, the thing that is in between and that we need to finance more is a project that is not just getting started and need more than $50K.
Yeah.
For example, like let's say social network, let's talk about Mastodon or whatever other software that's here or platform that's here and that could grow or that would need financing. The EDIC could be doing this. Like the EDIC needs to it would be cross-border projects that need to get more traction and get bigger. Digital workspaces is one. Cloud infrastructure is another key sector to boost. AI maybe, but AI is capital intensive, so maybe we will burn a lot of money and have less impact. So I would say digital workspace is one first thing to succeed, to have a strong, stong structure, know how to take care of your data and host your projects. Yeah.
Okay. So lots of exciting avenues there.
So do we want to do projects and books? Just as we finish up, maybe I think, do you want to go first? Is there a book that you wanted to recommend, Samuel, to?
Yeah, among tech books, there's one book that really saved my life. So I recommend it to anybody who's talking to me about tech more than 2 minutes. That's The Mikado Method. I don't know if you read that book.
I haven't read it. Carlton, you must have read it. You haven't read it?
No, I haven't, but I'm going to.
I'm going to buy it.
So Mikado Method is when I joined France Université Numérique, I had this big project, legacy project. It was a fork of OpenIDX, and it was really OpenIDX, a huge code base, and I had like thousands of commits of fork on OpenIDX, and something like really, really stuck in production with 3 million users. And I came to this project, everybody had left, like all the developers had been fired, and I was like alone with this huge code base. And I thought I'm really good at Django, but when I look at the code base, I don't understand anything. It's not the best practice code. Like OpenIDX has come some really, really complex parts. And I was really depressed there were two CTOs who resigned before me after taking the job. They stayed 2 months and they resigned. I was the third one to try. Yeah. And I told my brother about this and he said, okay, you should buy this book. This book is awesome because the game, the Mikado game, where you have all the sticks. You have all the sticks. You put them on the table. They are intertwined. And then you try to take one without moving the others. Yeah. And that's what you're trying to do with your code. You try to find the stick that you can take. And then once you manage to take a stick without breaking all the rest, you build it out of the monolith. And so that's what I did. I did for 6 years. And where it's really interesting is that from day one, you're able to take a Mikado and prove to your management that you're moving ahead. Like when they hired me, they said, we are not able to come up with one feature. Yeah. Yeah. In 1 year, we are stuck with this code base. If you touch something, it breaks. Yeah. So once I find a Mikado, like 1 month in the job, I was able to say, okay, you have a new tool. Now you have a new feature in this tool because I built it aside. And then we kept on taking Mikados and eventually rebuilt. Like, of course, it becomes a microservice infrastructure because you take your Mikado and make services. But from day one, you have impact. As a CTO, you can prove that, okay, now I'm fluid. Although you don't understand a word of all this monolith.
Yeah.
So this book is game-changing for someone who really comes to a big legacy code base and wants to show what they can do.
I'm actually having flashbacks as you're describing the situation of trying to extract this one bit of code. I'm like, oh, yeah, I need this book. I'm definitely going to buy this. So good.
And it's worse if you don't have tests. If you have tests, it's maybe too easy.
Carlton,
you can always write a Selenium test around the outside or something, right? There's something horrible.
Yeah, the books give you detailed techniques of how to, they have a technique where you pull the Mikado and if you see that too many things come together,
you put it back.
You just roll back. You just git reset and then you start another way. They have a whole technique to say, oh, maybe this is a good way.
Yeah, good.
It's perfect. Really smart. I like it.
Okay, I'm good. I'm going to order that later as soon as
we literally save my life.
Okay. Brilliant. So my book is Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson, which I'm just picked up. I saw it on Kindle. I thought, okay, I'm going to get that. It was the Millennium series trilogy, the Millennium trilogy. I'm fairly sure that Paolo Malicorne has mentioned this as his sort of one of his favorite books. And I saw it and I was like, oh, it's on special. Right. I'm going to get that. And it's good. I'm enjoying it. I'm just having a couple of, you know, a couple of quiet weeks away from the tech book. So I'm reading those. Yeah.
Can you put it in the comments? Yeah, we'll
Sorry, go ahead.
You put it?
Put it in the show notes? Sorry, I don't understand.
What... Yeah, in the notes. Yeah, I didn't get the title. So.
Oh, yes.
It's called Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Or in other languages, I think it's called The Men That Hated Women or Didn't Like Women or something like that. It's
like 15 years ago, I think it was a big thing, 20, maybe 20.
I mean, there were films a bit and all the rest, but there's a trilogy and the trilogy was all in one. I was like, oh, I'm fairly sure I've heard Paolo ranting about how he loves this set collection of books.
Well, the protagonist is a female coder, right? So you have to love it, right? Yeah. She solves problems with code. Okay, I'll go. I'm going to say a non-tech book, A Confederacy of Dunces, which is not a new book. It's an American book about politics. And I'll just say it seems still
ever more relevant.
Plus ça change. So it's a very good book. I'm reading it again. And
it looks really big. So.
No?
Okay. Oh, okay, good.
No, I had it close to the camera. Yeah, no, it's a classic. It won a Pulitzer Prize. And
anyway,
I will refrain from saying more. Quickly, projects. I'm going to highlight Django Live translations. I'll put a link into the show notes. This is a very recent project. In-browser translation editing for Django super users. So I will give it more of a play, but anything that does translations is interesting to me. So I'll put a link in that.
Okay.
Either one of you.
Samuel, go.
About a project?
Yeah.
Yeah, we mentioned earlier like Django Bolt. That's a project that really got me excited when I read about it. Like I said, to really use it with La Suite, it's quite a rewrite.
Yeah.
But maybe with AI, we can pull it off.
Well, I mean, I think Farhan, we had him on the podcast who created it. I believe he's still taking freelance opportunities, so maybe a special project he can do it.
I will mention since you've mentioned Django Bolt, I saw today on LinkedIn that he's got sponsorships and available now for the Django Bolt project. So, you know, any listeners who are interested in that could, you know, help out by just taking a small sponsorship of Farhan there for his work.
Got his first one. I saw that.
Keep it going. My project is related. I want to mention the Tech Empower benchmarks that have been the big web framework speed off for the last 10, 15, I can't remember how many years they've been around, but they've been around for a long time. And I just wanted to call them out because they're being sunsetted. And there was a pull request opened or an announcement opened that they're being sunsetted there. And it's been like, wow, that has been a sort of pillar in the API frameworks discourse for, you know, ages and ages and ages. But the tech empower benchmarks. So pour one out for those, because that's been a decade or more of really good work for the community.
Okay, we'll put a link to that. Was that new to you, that benchmark?
Yeah, it's new to me. I didn't know.
But it's worth checking. They've got these crazy frameworks written in, you know, assembly language that can do 85 million requests a second on a single socket or whatever. I don't, you know, exaggerate. Yeah. This kind of thing.
Okay. I guess, very, very last question, Samuel. Is there any, if there's something about Django, if you have a magic wand, one thing you can change, what would you like to change about the framework?
What I was mentioning earlier, like better support for WebRTC, for WebSockets.
Sockets,
WebSockets, yeah. Maybe I'm not up to date, but
Carlton, you're still maintaining Channels.
Yeah,
right?
No, I mean, I think Channels is perfectly capable. It depends on, you know, what you're trying to do or what throughputs, etc. But yeah, I mean,
we were running Django Channels at scale in my previous job with the same team, and when I the other day said, okay, let's use it again, the engineers who were taking care of the project said, well, no. I don't know exactly what the problem was, but they say it was not easy to scale and was not optimal, maybe.
I'm pretty sure that
some native support for this in Django at scale, like, well, for sure it could improve.
I think the issue is ultimately about the need to jump. It's not about Channels. It's not about the WebSocket implementation around Channels. None of that. It's about the need to handle the sync to async jump. Hitting the ORM, and that's the same everywhere. So completing the ORM's async story is ultimately what's the difficult bit.
That's support for async overall in Django.
Yeah, it's that the bit of the async story that's still being completed is the async support in the ORM. It's down to the cursor level, because the cursors, even if you've got async cursors, it's still a synchronous connection. Like, it's just that's pushed into the PsychoPG library rather than into the Django.
And would you say that we are making progress and it just takes time, or are we stuck on it?
No, it is ticking over. It is making progress. It's coming along. There's a nice, there's a third party package now, which is, it's got a kind of proof of concept stage there for fully async down to the cursor level. But then as people are exploring it, they're like, but this is happening and this is happening. And those really hard issues are coming up. And this is why it has to be done in a third party. You know, people are always like, why can't we merge it straight into Django? And the bottom line is because we can't experiment in Django. The stability guarantees and the life cycle are too long. And so there's this
it could eventually land into the core later.
Yes,
south of this guy.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's coming, but the context managers around which context you're sharing the connection between, and do you need to maintain the same connection for multiple calls, you know, into the ORM over the life cycle of that single? There are so many weird edge cases, and the bottom line is there aren't really any async ORMs out there. There just aren't. Yeah. I think a lot of people that are doing async code at scale, they're doing it with raw cursors. Rather than
remind me that when the edic is, if the edic works, that would be one of the projects that we should fund. Yeah. We should fund that. There would be a huge impact. So
right. Okay. Yeah. No. Also. Okay. When you get it up and running, ping us, and we'll see if we can get an application.
Yeah. I think now with the Django in last suite, we are greatly tied to Django's future. So yeah, definitely interested to support this community.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we can get the ORM story down to the cursor level, I've seen working with the context managers that you need and all the rest of it, if we can get that story finished, then the async story is complete. And it's not at the view level. That's all working perfectly fine. It's that when people need to call to the ORM, they do a sync to async, and there are complications around that.
And then one more thing, if I can add one more thing on typing, I personally didn't. I'm a bit like David Kramer's take to say, okay, he said I'm not going to code Python anymore, but I'm not down to this level. But developers around me are really into typing, and I didn't convert this. So I have big questions about it, and with AI, I feel maybe on one side we say we are going to stop writing code, and on the other way we make the writing the code more painful. In OpenAI SDK, I found one day I was in a file in the OpenAI SDK where there were literally like 1,000 lines. Just for the function declaration.
Yeah, right. Like, okay.
You know, the type, the type of the function, it was up to 1,000 lines. And I thought to myself, well, this is going too far. What are we doing? Like, I really love the Zen of Python, the readability, the, yeah. the easiness. And like typing for me, I think we made it. At least I'm not using it, and I find it hard to convert to this. So maybe AI. And AI is not going this way. It's AI should understand types, should be able to add types without me. Like, that's one of the things where I'm not sure I would like to. I'm not sure where we should go on this.
Yeah. I gave this is one of my topics that I've got at the moment. I gave a talk recently at JetBrains PyTV event in Amsterdam that perhaps we'll put the link again in the show notes. But my talk was, it was called Static Islands Dynamic Sea. And the idea is that Django's core is designed around dynamic patterns. And so it's going to be very hard for us to add, you know, type hints there. We'd have to rewrite the whole thing basically. But on top of that, we can put, you know, nice static islands where they help. But the
yeah,
question is, where does it help?
It's fine. Yes,
you know, nice data classes that have, and you know, the type annotations in there that tell you those are useful things.
Yes.
And
so that's one thing. Yeah.
It's knowing where to hold the line. I think if we try and retrofit typing into the core of Django, we will struggle because it's deliberately built around patterns which Python's type system can't express.
Well, that sounds like a whole other episode.
You will have to come back on, Samuel.
No, but I'm not competent on this subject, so I'm just hoping that you don't ask me to write function definitions that go up to the 1,000 lines. But okay, if AI writes it for me, why not? But I'm going to stop reading Python as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I read something, David Kramer said something like this. I thought, okay, at least one guy agrees with me.
David's always good for a controversial point as well.
Okay, in the interest of time, we will have links to everything in the show notes. Samuel, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And thank you for all of your work. It's very inspiring to see what you and your team have accomplished.
Yeah, I hope we go much further. And I love being in this community. I hope that there's a lot of nice things coming for our projects.
Cool.
All right. DjangoChat.com and on YouTube. And we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks again to 6 Feet Up, the Python, Django, and AI experts you call for the hardest software problems. From scaling applications to simplifying data complexity and unlocking AI outcomes, they help you move forward faster. See what's possible at 6feetup.com.